The Desert Island Discs with Flavia on Capital FM. Fresh hits for Uganda.
Welcome to Desert Island Discs. This Sunday, I've got the titled way to describe him would be he's the executive chairman of the Clark Group and the founder of International Medical Group. But I'm careful to say this, but I've had a guest a couple of shows back who had almost a similar history, but in a different category, who said, I don't mind being called a Muzungu who came to Uganda and turned things around. Well, but because I don't know why
I can't claim that. No.
Yeah, people never skip over the Muzungu part when they see someone. But I feel like you've integrated properly to be more of a Ugandan than a lot of people.
Apart from the language barrier.
You still can't speak the language, can
Luganda,
you?
Luganda, I just had to bluff my way.
It's fine. A lot of people bluff their way anyway. Welcome to the show, Dr. Ian Clark.
Thank you very much. And what did you get my Luganda name?
No.
Busulwa.
Busulwa.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a Muganda. Help me.
What does that mean? Kobetlan.
What does that do? It's just a name. Oh, okay. Okay.
I was given it a long time ago by Bishop Mazeri Kaoma, who was my boss at one time.
Okay.
Before you were born.
So, Dr. Ian Clark, I mean, I want us to go farther back. I mean, you're what, only 34? So we're just going a few years back to your childhood. You can't see him, but he's staring at me like, what? To your childhood.
My childhood.
Where your story begins. Just throw us into childhood as far as you can remember.
I'm Irish. I was born in Northern Ireland, which is actually part of the British Empire, the last colony. Born on a farm. My father was a farmer, and then he sadly died when I was 9.
Oh.
And I was the oldest boy in a family of 4, 2 girls, 2 boys. So I sort of became a farmer when I was very young. I basically helped my mum around the farm.
Right.
The tradition in those days was that the farm didn't get split up. In Uganda, people have land, and then they split it. It keeps getting split as you go on from generation to generation. But in Ireland, you would choose one family member, and that person would get the farm.
Oh.
So, and that would have been traditionally, although I wouldn't say it's true today, traditionally that would have been the eldest boy.
Mm.
So I would have been due to inherit the farm. However, I was still young and doing my education, so my mum kept farming and then sort of was kind of like, we'll wait to see how he turns out.
Yeah, if he will take over.
And I was doing medicine. So when I was a schoolboy, obviously I was a schoolboy, but I got into medicine. So once I got into medicine and my brother wasn't interested in the farm, actually the farm got sold off after
that. Oh dear. When you say farm to a Ugandan, obviously now you're also into farming here in Uganda. You know what that looks like, but what's the picture
there?
Yeah.
It was quite a nice, you know, small medium farm.
Mm-hmm.
It had 100 acres of quite good farmland. And so we did arable farming, and we also, our sort of specialty was chicken farming.
For me, farm life sounds, I mean, I'm just going to say it, boring. I wouldn't have a good childhood if I grew up on a farm, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I know some people are like that. They're just sort of city girls. You know,
yeah.
But I liked the farm as I was growing up, and I liked nothing better than to be sort of driving the tractor and cleaning out the chickens and, you know, collecting the hay or gathering the potatoes, all of that sort of stuff. So I actually really liked it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was very formative for me because it taught me to be self-reliant. It taught me to take initiative, work ethic.
Yeah.
So I think all of those things were, you know, they're sort of lessons. I often say that Ugandan boys, the boy child, if you like, gets a big disadvantage in Uganda because often it's the girls who are taught household management, looking after the other kids and all that stuff, and the boy is treated like this little keen.
Just
comes in and, you know, eats food and stuff. And then you find that that becomes a disadvantage because, you know, that the girls are actually better managers. I mean, in my time in Uganda, I have employed many, many women. Of course, on the farm, of course, I employ many men. I employ women as well, but as a generalization, I would say that the women have far outshone the men in terms of management skills.
Mm.
And I take some of that back to their childhood.
Right.
That, you know, just the way they were brought up.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I have 3 boys, I guess.
Three boys. Yeah. Well, you have to teach them to wash the dishes.
Must.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Talking about your parents, because you see, when you say that goes back to childhood, it means you've recognized the importance of our earlier years and how they were formative
yeah.
to who we become. Mm-hmm. I also believe the people around you who helped to raise you, because I mean, some people were raised by guardians, not necessarily parents. That's so true. You had mom, dad, and your siblings.
No, I just
how crucial were they in teaching you who you then became in hindsight?
So as I said, my dad died when I was 9, so it was really my mom. And I think that being the oldest boy in the household and having to help her to run the farm and look after the chickens and go to school, I think I became relatively self-reliant.
Sure.
And I think that has probably stood me in good stead.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, my kid brother, who actually just came to visit me in Uganda a month ago. He hadn't been out here for 17 years.
Oh, wow.
So it was lovely to see him. But he missed, you know, he seemed to miss his father more than me. I just seemed to get on with life. I was like, well, okay, I don't know what dad and I, so okay.
Yeah,
I know,
okay, you know. that's odd. I guess for you it was responsibility.
Yeah.
You have to grow up.
Yeah, you just had to, yeah, I think so.
Whereas for him it was, oh, I miss my dad.
For him, I think it was not having the dad. It was
kind of like
he was younger. He was almost 4 years younger than me. And so I think he was like, I don't have a dad. I was like, well, I did have a dad. Now I
don't
have a dad.
And he's not here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. That says something. I'd like to hear your first song choice right now, Dr.
Clark. Coldplay song, which I quite like. I don't know what its real title is, but I think the line of the like is "I will fix you."
Oh, it is "Fix You."
Yeah,
try it's "Fix You." Fix you. Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful song.
When you try your best, but you don't succeed. When you get what you want, but not what you need. When you feel so tired but you can't sleep, stuck in reverse, and the tears come streaming down your face, when you lose something you can't replace, when you love someone to waste, could it be worse? Lights will guide you home and ignite your bones, and I will try.
Island Discs with Flavia on Capital FM. Fresh hits for Uganda.
It's Desert Island Discs, and your first song choice, Dr. Ian Clark, was "Fix You" by Coldplay. You said you just like it, right?
I also like the words. I mean, I think I think Coldplay are amazing. You know, they're kind of my son's. You know, like there's a lot of 40-year-olds, which are my sons in that generation. You know, I suppose they introduced me to Coldplay, but it's a fantastic group. I mean, the guy's a genius in terms of his music.
Yep.
And that song also, I'm always trying to fix people. I know people trying to fix me as well, but I'm always trying to fix people.
Right. Yeah. Okay, makes sense. But it's a beautiful song. Coldplay, "Fix You." Whatever, if you walked anywhere on the streets in Uganda and said, Dr. Ian Clark. Do you already know what people would think?
About me?
Yeah. Not necessarily in depth think of you, but like the first, what you'd be synonymous for. A lot of people would just think hospital.
Hospitals. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people are Basulwa. You know, it's like they'll shout Basulwa, they shout chairman. So I think the time in politics was a lot of people knew me from that. I mean, I live in Mianga Tank Hill, and when I go jogging, if I am during the day, you know, a lot of the border riot guys and stuff will all shout at me.
In a good way?
Yeah, in a good
okay.
way. Yeah, in a good
okay.
Way.
So you said you ended up, you didn't take over the farm, obviously, because medical school came in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You wanted to do medicine.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
It was a choice.
So, well, look, you're really taking me really back to the dim, distant past.
We love
you
the like stories.
To do that, yeah. Sort of kind of psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do remember, you know, when I was about 15 or 16, thinking that the two professions that I would like to do would be farming or medicine. And the limitation with farming was that I would have to stay where the farm was.
Right.
And so I would be limited to a sort of fairly parochial existence, really, you know, because I'd be still in Ireland. Mm.
And at home, the same place, yeah.
Yeah. And then, whereas medicine, it's kind of a profession you can take anywhere. Mm-hmm. So that was what drew me to medicine, that I could have this profession that I could end up anywhere in the world, which is what happened.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
yes.
how I ended up here.
I mean, you must have fairly been a smart, by smart I mean intelligent child, because I mean, I'm not going to go just run around, maybe I could be a doctor or I could be a farmer, you know what I mean? Because I'm looking at what my strengths
by,
are.
I scrape by. I never thought of myself as a very intelligent person, but I'm not. I'm okay. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So then you pursued this. Tell me about how that journey went.
The medicine.
Mm.
It was fine. I did like 6 years at medical school. Then
still
we did
in Ireland?
1 year. Yeah, yeah. In Queen's University, Belfast. We did 1 year pre-med and then we did 5 years medicine. And after I finished my finals, I'm like, I'm never going to open a book again.
Oh.
and then I actually quickly got a job as a family practitioner.
Mm.
In those days, nowadays you do medicine, you do all your undergraduate stuff, and then you do like 7 more years to do anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
And but in my day, I could just sort of do. I did a few years. I did obs gynae, some experience in hospital medicine. That I did accident and emergency, and then this guy offered me a partnership in general practice, and I went into it. But I was actually bored. When I was quite a junior doctor, I got involved in doing some businesses, and that was a sort of maybe a reflection of the entrepreneurial streak or the farming or something. And so I was doing business and medical practice, and they weren't the same. When I came here, I did business, but it was hospitals, it was medical.
Yeah.
Whereas in Ireland, I did business, which was a furniture business.
A furniture business. Okay.
So I was delivering tables to and the customers the and delivering babies.
Right.
That didn't really make any sense. I was part of a church group. You know, you're supposed to be, if you're a Christian, you're supposed to be having a life that is impacting the world.
Yes.
You know,
changing people's lives.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff, you know? Mm. And then I was kind of like, and what am I doing? I'm hauling furniture around to save my own skin here. So, you know, so what does my life amount to? I'm treating little old ladies with blood pressure that a nurse could do. And then around that time, I think I also heard about HIV, because this was the mid-80s, and HIV was just unfolding itself in Uganda. 87, 88, you know, 6, 7, 8, like those times. I'm there thinking about, my goodness, people are absolutely just, in this country, they're losing their immunity. Mm-hmm. They just die of all these weird and wonderful fungal infections, and what am I doing? So it was that sort of feeling of, let me say, worthlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly worthlessness, but, you know, that my life
you
could be more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually, that was the motivation why I came to Uganda, and then somebody from the church, I mean, coincidentally then, somebody, it was just after, this was 87, so it was just when, you know, basically some sort of security had been restored to Uganda. We didn't have the Abodi 2 thing. So these guys are going to Uganda, and I said, oh, I'll tag along.
Okay.
And so I arrived out here, I remember we stayed somewhere in Nateri or somewhere. Anyway, I knew I was out in Rubaga, trailing through those red, dusty roads. And
I mean, Rubaga didn't change that much.
No. I mean, you go through Mango and Rubaga now sometimes, and, you know. Yeah. So I remember the red, dusty roads and people shouting, Mzungu, Mzungu. And I ended up in Rubaga Hospital working with the well-known, famous Stephen Watiti. Do you know Stephen?
Yes, but then you didn't have a plan coming. You were just tagging along.
I just came along to see. It was 2 weeks. I was coming for 2 weeks.
It was a kind of holiday.
This was a holiday.
Okay.
I just came to have a look at Uganda.
Right.
I'd never been in Africa. Didn't know anything about Africa. I hardly met a black person. Ireland was
honest.
This place.
Yeah.
It was this place. Nobody came to Belfast.
How do you then get to Rubaga Hospital to say, okay, let me just go try out.
I'm not quite sure who recommended. Somebody must have said, go to Rubaga. Mm. And Stephen Watiti at that stage was a medical officer, and he was working, as I remember, in OPD.
Right.
And Rubaga, I mean, you know what Rubaga's like. It was full of patients. You know, you had to squeeze your way through the crowd. And then Stephen was doing minor surgical procedures and stuff. And I sort of stayed with him for some days. And I was absolutely amazed at the stuff he was doing with so little resources.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, and look at me, you know, what am I doing? Then this character took us up to what was then the Luwero Triangle, or what, you know, was part of the Luwero Triangle. We went up through Luwero Town, and then we went out to this place in the bush called Kabubu on the way to Ngoma. Mm-hmm. And that had been an area where Museveni, they'd been in Ngoma at one stage, and that area had been like cleared, you know, the cattle were all eaten, the houses were all stripped, and but these people owned a big tract of land up there. Mm-hmm. They had at one stage owned 10 square miles. Oh. And they had a ranch house that had been partially demolished. It was like a concrete shell. Mm-hmm. But his grandmother was up there, and we went out to this area. And that's where they had all the skulls and the bones. Mm. And, you know, you had these skulls in, like, they would make a cane stand where they sold maybe cabbages, and then they'd have a stall of skulls beside it. They didn't mix them up, you know, one stall was skulls.
I mean, still, I don't want to be buying cabbages on one side and seeing a skull on the other.
They would have, like, you know, by the road, this was kind of the evidence of the killing,
right,
in 87, because most Kampalans then had never gone out. You know, they just were like, they stopped. They never went beyond Bombo, except for William Pike. He'd been out there.
Right.
My fellow Irishman, actually, he's an Anglo-Irish. But when I went out and heard the stories and all that, and then I came back, and Robbie said to me, my wife said to me, so, you know, so what do you think? And I said, we got to go back. You know?
Really? You came at a time, and I asked this to Gary Skin. I said, when you come at a time when the country is hollow and quiet and almost sad, and my first instinct wouldn't be to go back.
Yeah.
It'll be to avoid that darkness almost. Yeah, and exactly. You thought, yeah, because I mean, there's a hopelessness in the air, you
there
know?
There was, yeah. There was a sort of like, especially in that area.
Yeah.
So, you know, the next year we rocked up here. We got sponsorship from Church Mission Society. That's how I come out. People say, you were a missionary. And that's kind of like, for some people, that's like, oh, you're a missionary. That's very good. And other people say, oh, you're a missionary. You're a colonialist. You know, you paved the way for the colonialists.
So you just use it as an avenue to get here. It wasn't necessarily...
Yeah, really. Uh-huh. As I said, we were church going, and it fitted with my faith and all that. And, you know, it was Church of Uganda. We were Protestant.
Right.
And I came out. That's how Bishop Masarika was my boss, actually.
Right.
He was the Bishop of Namirembe, which then took in all of the Luwero area and all that. We came out to that very farmhouse, which some people had come out some months before us and sort of made it habitable. Okay. Except there's still a lot of rats in it. And so it was a bit of a struggle for the family. Well, for Robbie particularly. You see, white people don't like rats.
We all don't like rats, Dr. Clark.
I thought people just...
No, we don't like rats.
Not Uganda.
They're just here, but we don't like
them. Because the villagers would be like, well... Yeah,
they,
so you've
I mean,
got a
they're
rat
there.
You got your rat in your cooker, so what's the issue?
It's kind of like the potholes outside. I mean, they're there, but we don't like them. No, we don't like the rats.
Rats
so that's where you were supposed to like pitch. That's home. That was supposed to be home.
Did become home. We fixed up part of that house and stayed in what was a sort of little apartment upstairs. And then started to do community work. I worked with a girl initially called Janet Kulunji, if I remember properly, who was a World Vision worker. And so she translated it for me, because World Vision had a program out there,
right?
And they would have these Ugandans who were running, like, it was mainly, they would mainly do like sponsorship of children. Their workers would be mainly tracking the kids and making sure they got food,
right,
and all of that sort of stuff. And it was, as I say, it was very much a post-war time.
I thought you said your clinic was under a tree.
It was. That's the first clinic we did. I had a tin box of drugs, a stethoscope, and that was it. And then we moved the clinic from under the tree to the church festival. So the church was the only building that hadn't had the roof stripped off then, because everything had lost their iron sheets and their doors and stuff like that. But the church, apparently the soldiers then had been billeted in the church during the 82-86 war. And so it still had its roof on.
Okay.
So it was actually one of the few buildings that had a roof on it. And then you'd go up the steps, and on each side there was two little rooms before you went into the main church building. So I sort of took one of those little rooms as my
consultation room.
And I sat in a three-legged stool, and the patients lay on a mat on the floor. And Janet translated, and that was our start of our...
I mean, at that point, do you get a line of patients saying, let's go get fixed up? Or why the Mzungu here?
So what would happen is you get a line of the patients. So I was in the, if you're facing the church, I was in the left-hand vestibule or whatever it was called. And there would be a line went right round the church, round the back, and came round.
Wow, curved round.
You'd have like 400 people waiting or something like that. I would try to split up the patients, and because I knew a lot of them just came because it was this, there was a doctor, you know, it was kind of like supply and demand. Look, I'm all right now, but the doctor's there now, so I better go there in case.
You never know.
You never know. So I tried to split it and have people have my, I trained community health workers.
Okay.
So I would get these community health workers to see people, but they'd slip back into my line.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
So just in case, you know, the doctor might fix, I don't know what.
They knew Edward, you know, he was the lay reader, or, you know, or Livingston Badagania, he was the church. And he was fantastic. We used to go out and do clinics. You would have to drive, you know, like 3 or 4 hours, you know, round tree, you know, basically like, yeah, go left round that tree up there. Yeah. There seemed to be no roads. And then we would do vaccinations, we would do a clinic, and then he would baptize the children.
Okay.
You know, it was a total thing. You know.
But that's unique.
Yeah, it was good.
Instead of having them come over a couple of Sundays down the road, just get there.
When he was there, he would baptize them. Anyway, he'd get put on his white surplice, and the next thing I knew.
I love it.
After he had vaccinated them.
Oh, dear. I love it. What's your second song choice at this point?
What's my second one? Lucky Dubé. Lucky Dubé. I was, very sad that guy was killed.
Did you ever see him in concert?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I went like several times.
Here or?
Here.
Okay.
No, here. Nile Hotel.
Yes.
We had it there. Remember me?
Yes. In whatever you do, remember me. I love it.
Fantastic.
Island Discs on Capital FM. Fresh Hits for Uganda.
It's Desert Island Dis, and a good storyteller. I don't know if you knew that. Dr. Ian Clark. Do people ever say, pardon me? Maybe because it can't get through the accent sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes I have to apologize. Apparently, I never really lost the accent. Never really learned Luganda, so I'm hopeless. I mean,
In between.
Well, the funny thing is, I really like Ugandans, and okay. I'm very easy with Ugandans, and this is my home, and yet somehow I'm a bit dumbass in terms of language, or obviously maybe adopting to the accent as well. Mm. So I think I still have to, I'm sure there'll be people listening to this program and be like, what? What's he saying? And sometimes I have to slow down.
Right. Just so you can be understood. Mm, yeah. So the clinic has patients, you're getting to know people. How do you scale that into what we then got to know?
Chioko Hospital. It was always the need that drove me. I mean, I went from this situation where I felt like, so what? What is my purpose in life?
Right.
To a context where I'm in the middle of an AIDS epidemic and a TB epidemic as well. And it's all very basic, and it was at the stage when, we didn't really have rapid tests to start with. And there was one stage when the Ministry of Health went through and said, no, you don't need tests to diagnose people if they have A, B, and C, they have AIDS.
Symptoms, they're,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
it.
Uh-huh. Wow. And so you were developing everything. So I started, the first thing probably that pushed me was people having babies on my doorstep. I'd be like, what? We lived this farmhouse that we partially fixed up.
Yeah.
In the mornings, it would be like, there's all this sort of hubbub because I was on the floor and then they were in the ground. I was on the first floor and you'd hear people like from before light. And then you'd realize that there was a whole bunch of people on the veranda. And then sometimes somebody would be having a baby or having twins or something on the doorstep. So you'd have to rush down and
help.
Of course, yeah. But the problem wasn't that. The problem was the woman who got into obstructed labor, and we had nowhere, we couldn't deal with it, So I'd have to put them in my little, Suzuki Jeep, and drive them. The road was horrible. Mm. It was a good 2.5 hours to Kampala. And sometimes that was the middle of the night. And I was driving through this area that had previously been, like a no-go area. So we had to do something that was actually bringing care to the area. Mm. So a friend of ours died, actually the pastor of our church, his wife died. And then he decided to start a memorial fund. And that's what gave us the first money to build a clinic. And then the clinic just sort of got bigger and we had to develop a laboratory and a theater and all that stuff. So it was the needs around us that pushed us. We didn't sit back in Ireland or sit in the program and say, aha, let's build a hospital here.
Let's do this. Yeah. And that first hospital became?
That's Chioko Hospital.
Chioko Hospital.
That hospital is going on very well today. And now we've been very fortunate with that hospital because we have three sources of income. One is local people pay, but they pay a very low price.
Yeah.
The second one is kind of small organization that we set up many, many, many years ago, which is known as Friends of Chioko Hospital, and they would raise money. A lot of doctors, a lot of medical people, and churches would contribute to that.
Does it exist, Friends of Chioko Hospital?
Yes, Chioko. Still there, like 30 years later. Mm. And the third thing was there was an organization called Adara from Australia that got interested, actually. It was a kind of a funny thing because the lady who started that organization, Odette, is Australian, and she rocked up in Uganda, went to see the first lady, as one does, and said, I want to do good or I want to help. Okay. And the first lady said to her, go and see Chioko Hospital. So they knew about us from, they've been supporting mother and child, neonatal care. There's a wonderful neonatal unit in Chioko, a big unit. Mm. And what's amazing is that some of the nurses who started with me 30 years ago are actually still there today.
Whoa.
I mean, there was the one called Christine who won an award recently just for the amazing work that she's done. So that hospital goes on very well, led and run, by Ugandan staff.
Mm.
I stay involved. At the present time, I'm chairman of the finance committee because that is a good linkage to the donors and the hospital and stuff. But otherwise, it's...
The ops are somebody else on the other team. You mentioned your wife a couple of times in this part of the story, especially from the point where you were saying, let's go back.
Yeah.
I think she asked the question of, what now? the first time you came to visit. You were husband and wife at that point before your first visit to Uganda.
I was married when I was very young.
Yeah, by choice. I mean, listen, things happen, Dr. Clark. You know, life happens. Sometimes life happens.
No, I was married when I was a medical student, so I was young. Yeah. And Robbie and I have been together for a long time. Robbie, when she came out, thought she was coming for like 2 years.
When you came to live here and to work here.
Yes, that's so right. I came out for the visit first, and then when I went back, said, we got to go. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't as if I was going to go without my family. So the whole family came out.
At the time, it was you, her, and?
Three kids, Sean, Michael, and Lauren. So Sean,
they were young at that point.
Sean was 11. Michael was 9, I think. Lauren 7, something like that. Their ages keep changing, you get confused.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
They, first of all, came out and lived with us in Luero, and Robbie was doing homeschooling, which really wasn't sustainable.
Okay.
But we thought at first we would only be there for 2 years, and then that part of the story stretched into 5-6 years. Then we went back, and they got into schools and stuff, and then I came out again.
Oh, okay. On your own.
I came out on my own, and then Robbie joined me again.
Okay.
But by that stage, they were, I think, anyway, they got into higher education then. And then Sean, my oldest boy, joined me. He's a Ugandan citizen now as well, he started Clark Junior School and runs that. I was there today. They had a cultural day, and it was amazing. These little kids all dressed in their kamzis and their western, because they did, you know, west, right. Central. So Sean trained as a teacher and then did an MBA, and then... So he loves education, you know, and he really wants to make an impact in that area. Mm. So yeah, my family came. We all came, and eventually they went to boarding school after a while in Kenya. So we were going back and forwards between Kenya and stuff.
I mean, it doesn't sound like everything was glossy and nice. I mean, how do you, as a partner, I feel like there's a lot my husband would have to convince me about his passions.
Yeah.
I mean, you can love someone.
Yeah.
But you know that you loving the person and the passion sometimes becomes
It was tough. It was very tough for Robbie initially. Got a little better because as I told you, we were in this sort of isolated farmhouse. But when we started building the hospital, which was about 3 or 4 kilometers away from where we stayed, we then had to build ourselves some accommodation at the hospital. The hospital was near the church where we did the clinic, just part of that compound. So we built a house there. And then we moved up to the hospital. So when she became part of the community, it was much better. And then, you know, when it came time to leave, I had to leave because I got cancer. Well, that was part of the reason then. But when we came time to leave, then that was, you know, she was now part of that community.
Yeah. She was integrated within the people.
Yeah, and that's right.
She had her own passions now. Mm-hmm. So it was a people.
That's right.
Cancer?
I got cancer at the end of that time. I had to go back to get treatment in Ireland. Obviously, I survived. I thought I was going to die.
Is that the 90s now? Or were we in the 2000s?
Yeah, 90s, yeah. You were in the 90s. But 94 or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, around that time. And then I recovered from the cancer. And what was interesting about that phase of my life, which was miserable, I was lying there. I remember lying in bed like a skeleton. But I thought, you know what? I have been in the midst of the AIDS epidemic. And then I've got what they call a dread disease. I've got this dread disease myself. I thought I was going to die. Even though I'm miserable now, I will probably survive this. So, you know, that probably sets the stage for the next part of my life. You know, I can't just now go back being a doctor in Ireland where there is no HIV and where, you know. And so I remember having those thoughts. But I can tell you, I believe life's in seasons. Right. Now, I don't mean the season of just you're a student in Europe, but there's different, if you look at your life, you're just gone into a new season because you've decided.
That's why I'm nodding, because I absolutely understand seasons. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you're in this season with these kids and
it requires you to be a different person as well.
It's different challenges.
Yeah.
It's different challenges. So I thought, all right, now I'm coming into a new season. So what should that be?
Right.
And there was a lot of pressure because we'd been out working in Uganda for 6 years. We didn't have any money. Mm. I did a master's in public health in London.
Okay.
And we lived around outside London. So the pressure on me was to earn a livelihood to, you know, put my family through school and stuff like that. And yet my psychological thinking was, no, I can't do this. I can't go back to the normal middle class UK lifestyle. Look at all the stuff that I've right. seen yeah. and I've experienced, and you know,
you can't just forget about it. You don't just pack up and say, oh.
And it was uniquely sort of qualified by experience and everything to empathize with such people, because right. then because AIDS then people were like, it was a, you know, when you were told you had AIDS, then you were going to die. So I ended up, you know, to coming back to Kampala, but this time just on my own steam.
Right.
Took a loan. Increased the mortgage on my house, and started a clinic in Kampala Pentecostal Church building, the Watoto Church.
The IMC clinic at the.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That was the first clinic I started. So I went and sat there and waited for patients, and it was like a sort of dumbass thing to do, in the sense that who leaves a developed country, comes to a developing country and starts a private practice? Because it was a private practice, people had to pay for it. But my thinking was that I had been, if you like, in the AIDS sector. Mm-hmm. So people were, so I was, you know, the hospital in Choco was charitable.
Yeah.
It was highly subsidized. Because
that was running.
It was that was up and running. Yeah. That was up and running. So I didn't need to go back. I'm not somebody who keeps going back.
Right,
to things.
Right.
And I thought, look, Uganda needs to develop, and development is about growth. Development is about people paying for services, goods and services.
And getting quality services.
And getting quality services. Yeah. So I thought, if I do this thing myself, people pay for it, and what I want to do is build a hospital. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, first it was a clinic, and then we did a small old Kampala. We had that was our first hospital. And that's when I employed a lot of these woman managers. So there's people right. like Hannah Magola, that's Rachel Magola's sister, our own daughter, Rose Nanyonga, who's now the first professor of nursing in Uganda, and Dr. Marianne Kalnan, and just amazing people who really made the thing happen.
I'm going to hear your third song choice.
Juliana. I would like Juliana.
Juliana Kanyomozi.
I think Juliana Kanyomozi is a wonderful singer, a great person, has been through many trials herself, but got a fantastic voice. Particularly her early songs are really, really...
Right.
When she was doing your job, I remember once...
we worked here together.
Yeah, I mean, she's a fantastic artist. So Juliana Nabikoa.
Yeah, okay.
Is that all right?
Nabikoa.
I tried to say that. Nabikoa. Okay.
Great. Yeah.
Desert Island Discs with Flavia on Capital FM. Fresh hits for Uganda.
It's Desert Island Discs. Juliana Kanyomozi Nabikoa. That was your third song choice, Dr. Ian Clark. So I'm hearing that story, and I mean, sometimes it pains me when I hear stories on here of business, because when you see a business flourish on the outside looking in, it's like, oh, great, they're lucky, everything looks nice. When you hear the person speaking about their business, and you're like, oh, it's a lot of work every day to build this great business to be what it is. I want to hear first about how you, because today I wouldn't go to the hospital and you're wearing a stethoscope to take care of me. You got out of active medicine, right?
Yeah, I don't think I've been doing clinical meds for quite some time.
That was you saying, I don't want to do it, I want to focus on the business end of medicine.
So it's time. It's really time. If I were taking the time to sit in a clinic and see patients, then there's a lot of other things that I wouldn't be able to do.
Right.
And so, you know, the hospital is a very, very complicated business. I mean, I read a book about hospital business, and the guy who wrote that book said a hospital is not one business. It's like 30 different businesses
in
all
one.
Combined.
Yeah.
It's like this. If you have a factory that makes, say, bolts or nuts or something, and that's all they do, they can be very efficient. If you have a factory, I mean, they've done the studies on this. If you have a factory that makes all kinds of car parts, they become inefficient. And the hospital is making all the kinds of car parts because you have, like, your accident emergency, an emergency part, then you have your obstetrics part, then you have your theaters, then you have your laboratories, then you have your diagnostics and your x-ray, then you have your hospitality side and your inpatients. And it goes
and they all
on
must
and on.
Work.
And they all have to work, They all have to work. And then the other thing is, you're dealing with human lives. You're dealing with human beings. I mean, we've just witnessed this tragedy in Israel where they're attacked by Hamas, and now the loss of life. And, you know, it's absolutely tragic because it's human beings. And, you know, I think you have to be a very callous person to watch if somebody dies and not feel for it. And doctors were, at least I'm not insulated, you know, oh, I'm just a doctor and I don't, you know, I separate myself from the grief or from the pain. When a patient would die in the hospital, it would, not every patient, but there'd be patients who died and it was unexpected, especially mothers. When mothers died, it was disastrous always. And sometimes you got very, very unfair criticism, but it was just because that family's lost a mother. You know, you've just had a couple of babies, you know. I mean, it just doesn't bear thinking about. And so the emotional weight that you carry, as well as, you know, the trying to make sure everything's done right, is really, there's a lot of pressure. Someone said to me, oh, is farming not very pressured? Well, it is. Financially, it's very pressured, but it's only money.
Yeah,
it's not people. It's not people's lives. Whereas medicine is people's lives. Running a hospital is people's lives. And so there's never been a point at which I didn't feel responsible, not only for my own shortcomings or mistakes, but for other people's.
Right.
You know, because I'm the guy in charge. It's a pressured existence. And you have to be looking at, I can't just be sitting there giving one person my time. I need to be enabling and facilitating the whole machine to work.
Right.
So that can be other doctors, that can be calling people to account, that can be making sure systems work, you know, making sure the financial side works, making sure the clinical pathway works,
right.
You know, all kind of things. Yeah.
So
I've been doing that medical management.
Sitting in a consultation room wouldn't be...
It's just a one part of it.
Yes.
Now, I had to know... I would have to know about theatre equipment. So I had to be, this is what I talk about being a generalist. I'm the ultimate generalist. So I would need to know, you know, what's the best C-arm to buy? What's, you know, what kind of theatre equipment? I'd go to these medical health equipment exhibitions, and I'd have to understand and know. And so that's, you know, all of that is part of running a hospital. It's important.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, I see that. So it was almost inevitable for you to get out of the one consultation room into the business end.
Into
of
the
things.
Whole, the whole business side of it. Yeah.
I wonder how, not maybe not today, because today you're on the business end of things so much that it's one well-oiled machine, or you would like it to be. But I wonder years ago how much or how involved you were in the actual way of how things run at IHK.
I'm a very detailed person.
Yeah?
You know, I'm a person who double checks things.
Okay.
And whatever I'm doing, I will try and get into it. Right at the minute, I'm trying to understand composting and organic fertilizer and manure and things like that.
Yeah.
I've obviously had to learn about coffee and the production of that.
I'm
actually doing, I don't know if I'd call it research, but I've done, on my farm, it's at 1,200 meters. And generally, that's a better altitude for Robusta coffee than for Arabica. Arabica grows at 1,600 meters and up. Arabica can grow at those 1,200 meters, but not usually so good. And I've been trialing an Arabica clone, which over the last 3 years has done very well. You know, so you just, you know, and one of the things I find about farming or about anything in life, you need to understand yourself. You need to research. Mm-hmm. You need to get the knowledge. And, you know, so I'm always on that journey of learning, whether it's making manure or whether it's understanding how hospitals run. And I think, you know, that's, again, different seasons and you learn different things, but the knowledge you tend to build. Like I'm back to farming, I'd say. We started with me on a farm, my childhood.
Yes.
So now, but that farm is 100 acres. The farm I have now is 1,500 acres. The farm was in Ireland. This farm's in Africa. That farm is growing potatoes. I'm now growing coffee. So it's always a journey, and it's a journey of building and a journey of learning and a journey of progress. Yeah.
All right. So I want to hear your next song choice.
Talaso? Mulamu. Is that right?
Malamu.
Sure. You should be arrow, baby, straight to the yard. Ogenda no tunuri danze nesa balala. And slowly I might be falling in love. I will never ever take you for granted. Tu baba biri ne yo joke seleza. You want it on the beat alone ne kombelela. Ononya kamera nga tenza njirina. Kukalero nina kukulaba. Sebuli tendi na chicho baby. Omukono kwendi na mubo baby. Sebuli tendi na chicho baby. My baby pretty pretty like a rose flower. Sebuli tendi na chicho baby. Sinema bwe kabanga kanyuma, kakaba kanyuma tu sana ngane tukadamu. Omutima gwange, obango bagala kutwale, obango bagala kutwale. Omulamu gwange, obango bagala kutwale, obango bagala kutwale. Sebuli tendi na chicho baby, omukwano gwendi na mubo baby. Sebuli tendi na chicho baby, my baby pretty pretty like a rose flower. Habari jachikere zibari tusanga kumbaga. Hojanga nengu sigire omogati kwa pata. Kachai kamdala sini muchiko pocha kama. Bina shua wa my baby jotia. Unweza nga chokute wakute jota. Kwa wadiro mozanyo nogu gazia. Kwa wanikeri je watatuka. Zebuli teni na chicho baby. Omukwano kweni na gugo baby. Zebuli teni na chicho baby. My baby pretty pretty like a rose flower.
Desert Island Discs on Capital FM. Fresh hits for Uganda.
It's Desert Island Discs, Palaso Malamu. Probably a shocker that you requested that one. do you get time to listen to music though, Dr. Clark?
Listen to music?
Yeah.
I like Ugandan music. I like classical music as well.
Right.
But if I'm with Ugandans on the same on the farm and stuff like that, it's you inflict classical music on them and they're all like, what's wrong with this guy? But they,
our ears are cringing. Yeah.
Yeah. But by the way, I mean, very many very good Ugandan artists. You know, it's amazing to me how many good.
Lots of talent.
A lot of talent. Yeah.
You decided to. Politics is a I think it's a dirty game.
Yeah.
You know, I had a guest recently who said they only went in because they like the truth. I said, I don't know if that sounds like a high price to pay just to get into something like politics. But you chose, should I say leadership or politics?
No, I went into politics because of potholes.
That was actually serious? I thought you just said that just to get people
to
rally
behind.
That's actually true. Okay.
It's actually true. If you roll back now, it's 10 years ago,
yeah,
before Jennifer Masisi came in.
Mm.
So I live in Tankhill, and I would have to go into town, and I'd have to come along 8th Street, Namoongo,
yes,
Road,
yes,
go down Sally Stage over the railway line and go into town. And there was always a big tailback. And the tailback was a combination of potholes,
mm-hmm,
and silt that had been cleared from the drains but left on the sides of the road so that you only had like a single lane,
mm,
on each way. And we would sit in this
traffic.
Mm. And garbage every time it rained, of course. You know what people do in Kasugu? When it rains, they say, aha, the garbage man is coming. They throw all their garbage in the drainage channels, mm-hmm, and it all washes down to whatever's,
yeah,
lower than them. So you'd have garbage all over the road. You have potholes, you had silt and all that. And I just thought, surely we can do better.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who's like this part of town? I knew there was LC3 chair people.
Mm.
And I said, who is it? And I think it was, I can't remember, Kalunji, I think it was his name. Yeah, and so, and I actually interacted with Kalunji a bit,
uh-huh,
but he didn't like me. Well, he didn't like me because I suppose I took his job. But I thought, I just felt you could do better. And I thought, and that's why I went in to try. I was ashamed. This is where I live. This is the country I was.
And this is what we
visitors
have.
Were coming, and you're like, mm-hmm. And so I was ashamed.
Home.
And so I thought, we can do better. And I had other people. There was enough people working for me at the hospital at that stage, you know, that I could
devote time
for
to
the
this?
Time.
Okay.
And I thought it was below the political radar, which I was right about that in the sense that it was not really a party political. The LC3 chairperson, people weren't so bothered. Okay, I mean, there's less people come out to vote in that election.
Yeah.
Now I was wrong after I did 5 years in that position and thought I would stand for Mackenzie East as MP because that was very party political.
Yes.
And I was not a member of a party, so I was pushed aside.
Why didn't you choose a party?
I don't want to be a party yeah, politician. I don't want to be any party. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And also don't forget, I'm a naturalized Ugandan. So
yeah,
I'm in a
Are
funny
you treading
position.
Carefully?
No, I'm saying the truth. I'm in this position where, you know, I just don't want to get in. You said politics is a dirty game.
Yes.
It was dirty, okay, but it was dirty because of the block drains and all of that stuff. But it wasn't dirty in the sense of double cross and stabbing people in the back and all that.
Sabotage.
It was local politics. I'm reading a book at the minute by a guy called Stuart, Rory Stewart, who, fantastic book. He was in the government of England or the UK, and he even stood for prime minister and was defeated. And then he wrote a book about politics. And it was amazing to me how many similarities there were between politics in Namoongo and Kampala and politics at Westminster and stuff. And yes, it is a dirty game. And his conclusion was that politics changed people because they became hypocritical and they towed the party line and all that. I never got that far. I don't think it changed me in that sense because I was still cleaning the drains and, you know, fixing the potholes and stuff. Yeah. So and the bit that Rory Stewart liked most was the constituency or local politics, not the Westminster stuff. And that's what I would say. I was able to make more difference
there
by getting out with a crew that was fixing the potholes. I used to give those guys, they'd be out there sweating in the sun. You know the way they dig the potholes out and then they fill them with marum and then they bring tarmac. And it's a when they bring the tarmac, and especially, you know, it's like hot and messy, and I would buy them some chapatis and some water. And they loved it, you know. I mean, I would
chapatis and water.
I mean, like, what I'm saying is I would provide 20,000 shillings so those guys could have a snack. And you know, they got paid, you know, and they got other things. But just the fact that I took an interest.
Yeah,
and they
made a difference.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, yeah.
Interesting. And so obviously that end of the politics
career.
Or the lit is off. You had gone in for the potholes. They're still there.
No, they came back again.
Mm.
They came back again. Yeah. I mean, potholes have a life of their own. They move around. Yeah.
Politics
won't
change them.
Worse.
Exactly.
But the problem is that with the present dispensation is Jennifer Musisi had a strong political connection and was able to get the funds
done.
And I don't know what's happened in this present dispensation, but I mean, I know Dorothy, who's the current executive director, but obviously there's big issues in terms of allocation of funds and
implementation or action.
Yeah.
If you look at the health or medical sector, because that's the category you've been in for a long time.
Yeah.
Because you started years ago. That's what, 3 decades ago?
Yeah.
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 A lot has changed.
Yeah.
Mostly good, I guess. Some
Not quick enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Not quick enough.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Where could we be? Why are we not getting there?
I think the biggest issue is the funding keeping up with the rapid pace of the population growth. So when I came to Uganda, there was 12 million people, I think. And now there's 48.
Yep.
So you've had a quadrupling in this space of 3 decades. Now, even if this was, I don't know, Sweden or some rich country, they would still be... It's a huge demand. If you read Friedman and some of these development analysts, they're just like, it can't be done.
Mm.
So even if you take an education budget, the idea of UPE was great.
Yeah.
You had an education budget. But if you looked at the increase in size of the children who need educated plus the increase in our budget, they just don't match.
They don't match. Yeah.
So there's hardly anything that matches. Same thing with health. Mm. You know, the increase in population, increase in our health budget. And those health budgets weren't big to start with. Mm-hmm. Like I can tell you for a fact in Chioko Hospital, we used to get a government subsidy of up to about 10%. They would give you what they call budget support for that. That's dropped to now about 1% or something like that. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. No, it's. I mean, because it hasn't increased in real terms. In fact, it's probably
okay. Yeah. So right. Yeah.
So we just don't.
It's not a priority. It is.
Everything's a priority, but we don't. I don't know. You know, Ugandans are reported to be some of the happiest people in the world, which is probably true. When you meet people, they're just amazing and what they put up with and that. But this sort of sense of seriousness where people will look at statistics and say, we've got a quadrupling of the population. How are we going to make budgets keep up with this?
Needs, yeah.
Yeah. You don't, most politicians don't do that. I mean.
So you said it came from IAA to, because I get confused as IAA, which then became IMC. And then this IHK. So, I'm always like,
no, I started
which
with,
is which?
No, I started with International Medical Center. That was IMC. And then that became an international hospital.
Yes.
And then we multiplied a lot more international medical centers.
Yeah.
And then we developed the medical insurance part, which was IAA.
Oh, wow.
But then I developed a university as well.
Yes.
So that was International Health Science University. We trained a lot of nurses and that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And now that's Clark International University. So because we're trying to broaden our scope. I'd like to do agriculture in that, for example, train farm managers.
Right.
You know, there's so much that you could do.
You do have a teaching aspect to most of the things you do.
Yes, you're trying to, it's development.
Right.
Trying to develop people.
What have you done that's going to help us put more quality in our years physically?
I exercise. That's probably the main thing I do because I'm not like, I don't smoke. Smoking is really detrimental to your health. And I just don't think anybody should touch the stuff.
Right.
But then other people do, there's probably as Ugandans, we drink too much alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But I drink alcohol, so I'm not condemning it, but it definitely.
Occasionally or? Okay. That sounds like it's one or two.
Well, sometimes, you know, when I'm jogging on the farm, I jog in the evenings, and after I have, you know, come back, I mean, like really worked up a sweat, you know, it's nice to have a beer, a cold beer.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Does the 80-20 actually work where you 80% make great choices on your plate and it's okay if you can 20% of
the time? I think so. I think so.
Allow yourself some indulgence.
I think if you're too purist, it's not.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, I think so. And you have to.
You do realize we're asking this because you're a doctor, and so if you say this, we're going to do it.
Yeah, you know why not? But I mean, I've written quite a bit about healthcare, and you know, there's a lot of guys who, you know, they get to their 50s and 60s, and then they fall down dead.
Yeah,
and that's because of poor cardiovascular systems. You know, their circulatory system, their blood vessels have been inflamed for years and years and years, and then they get a stroke or whatever. And so, a combination of being overweight. And that's overeating, simply. Being overweight, being stressed out, not taking exercise, you know, eating too much pork, fatty meat type of things, and so on. you know, you can be an accident waiting to happen. Whereas, you know, I see quite a number of the hashers are in their 60s, 50s and 60s.
And you can be running for 20 plus years and not be okay. Wow. Yeah. I just walk, you know, Kololo here. I just park the car and I walk for about an hour.
Yeah,
you and need I feel to like brand new.
Walking so and running, yeah.
Good. Yeah. The good stuff. Uh-huh. Your heart just feels like, wow.
Yeah.
So it's amazing. So I get you. But 25 years? May we be you. May we become you. So for somebody listening, most of the guests I ask them, I mean, in hindsight, for all the 3+ decades that you've worked or just experienced life, the thing about being a doctor, you're not like any other profession that says, I'll take a sabbatical and go study and then come back and practice. You learn on the job. You practice on the job.
Everything you have to keep up with evidence-based medicine and stuff.
But while you are on the job. So I'm going to ask you this. Your advice shouldn't be necessarily medical, but life.
Right.
What you would tell somebody with your experience in your life has made you who you are, a success. However you describe success. What has worked? Is it you?
Give me that question again.
it's sort of like how somebody says tips. What has made me work?
Oh.
Sam will tell you I wake up 5 a.m. every day.
I'm still a work in progress, all I can say.
All of us are. All of us are.
I think that's something maybe I don't say so often, is a bit of discipline.
Right.
I think that...
A bit of? Yeah, Dr. Ian Clark, I think a lot of discipline would be useful.
Yeah, but I think you have to enjoy life as well. I'm not somebody who's like, I'm not an austere person. I'm not... I enjoy life. I enjoy... you know, I don't, apart from, like, I would never do smoking or drugs or gambling. You know, those are, like, to me, no-nos, you know, sort of. And a lot of other things are in moderation, you know, and I would try to, I wouldn't, I try not to overeat. As I say, I exercise and I wouldn't take a lot of sugar, those kind of things. But I also read a lot. And also now I have Audible books. And so when I'm going up in the vehicle up and I have a 4 or 5 hour drive, I'll be on a Sunday when I'm doing nothing, I'll read. And then I watch YouTubes. I'll watch Netflix and that stuff as well, but sometimes I get a bit bored with it. You know, I'll be watching YouTubes about, I don't know, growing bamboo or
oh dear,
composting.
And you call that fun?
I love Grand Designs.
Okay.
You know, Grand Designs, you know, the architecture program. I really like that. Yeah, so I think we're always developing. We're always a work in progress. And so if we have that mindset, it's a change mindset. Mm. I told you, I'm not a really brilliant or bright person, but I'm quite keen to learn. And
you're adaptable to every situation. What about people? What have you learned about dealing with people that you could share with us?
The thing about people is you should start with an attitude of acceptance. Mm-hmm. You know, like Ugandans are classic. You know, they if you accept them, they'll accept you. But yes. Ugandans will not go out of their way for you. You know, so if I come here as a Mzungu and I'm like, you know, I have my sort of social habits and so on, and I expect Ugandans to just bend toward me. They're not going to do it. Mm. You know, if the guy is used to going to his local, you know, sitting in the street with his beer or whatever, that's what he'll do. You know, he'll not come to your house for dinner, or he'll not invite you back.
You try.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the problem is that I used to say to my reception, smile.
Right.
You know, because. Because people will respond to a smile, but if an irate patient or, you know, somebody who's, you know, some big shot comes in, they're not going to smile at you. So you have to actually do that.
Initiate it.
Thank you, Flavia. So that's one of the things. I think I am a fairly inclusive person.
Right.
And because I'm well known, a lot of people will...
gravitate towards you?
Well, they have no problem smiling at me. Most of them. I mean, there must be those.
We know a lot of people, Dr. Ken Clark, but we're not necessarily smiling at them.
No, but no, I know.
It's
but
how they've lived their lives as well, you know. So that's a great tribute to how you've lived your life.
I don't know. I mean,
because I'm not sure if there are circles where your name, Dr. Ian Clark, will induce some anger or trigger.
Sure,
do you know what I mean?
I'm sure.
And if they're there, I don't know what you did.
But they're there.
But for the most part, everybody's like, yeah, great stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I remember some people, you know, who I there. I remember one guy, and he was like, "Yeah, there he is. There you are, pontificating." This was, you know, because I'm always writing in the newspapers.
Yeah,
and I'm sure some people don't like what I write.
Right.
But I'm not really trying to pontificate, I must say. Mm. The good thing is I've been here for so long, and I'm comfortable with Ugandans. Ugandans have made me one of them.
One of us,
and so therefore I feel free to be myself. I am not an African expert. I just live here. This is my country. You know, like, I'm an Irish person and I love Ireland, but I only go there like 2 or 3 weeks in a year.
Oh, wow.
The weather's too wet.
This is home.
This is home. Yeah. You know, so yeah.
I'm glad you made it home, and thank you for making time for this therapy session.
Yeah, thank you, Flavia.
Right?
The therapy, yeah.
Yeah. What's your final song choice as we let you go?
Julie Sasanga. She used to sing with a group called Big Five.
Yes. Yeah.
Beautiful singer.
Julie Sasanga. We'll absolutely find something from her. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Flavia. Oh, thank you for the therapy session.
Yeah.
Just let me know how I make you feel.
Absolutely. Will do. That's it for Desert Island Disc. Good night.
Flavia on Capital FM. Fresh hits for Uganda.